This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And welcome to the new Beit Medrash. It will take us a few weeks before we actually work out the best configuration of seating, so please bear with us until we do. In general, the ladies' entrance is over here, and the men's entrance is on that side. So whatever we do, we'll try and work it that at least people coming into the shir, if the ladies use this entrance and the men use that entrance, they'll land up in the right place. If you're here on time, it makes no difference, obviously, but if you come late, then it's just facilitates getting to your place if you come through the main entrance. I don't yet know exactly how we'll be organizing it, but it'll take us a few weeks to settle in. I want to start something this week that I'm not sure we're going to really even be able to finish this week, and we might have to go on for at least another week on it, and that's a discussion of the last two of the Ten Commandments. The way it's recorded in this week's Seder, the Ten Commandments, the ninth one is that you shall not desire the wife of your friend. And you shall not desire the house of your friend, his field, his servant, his maidservant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that he has. The tenth commandment. In Shmos, the other place where the ten commandments are recorded, there are a lot of differences. In fact, altogether, there are many differences between the Aseres HaDibros, the Ten Commandments as they are recorded in Shemot, and as they are recorded here in Dvorim. Firstly, the ninth and tenth commandments are switched around. In Dvorim, the ninth commandment is Lo Tachmod Beis Re'echa, you mustn't desire the house of your friend. And the tenth commandment is Lo Tachmod Eishes Re'echa, you shall not desire the wife of your friend. And then it goes on, Ve'avdoi Ve'amotso Ve'shoire Ve'chamoire Ve'chol Hashel Re'echa. That is the tenth commandment as it's recorded here. And I want to talk about this issur of loy tachmoid, the issur of not coveting, not desiring. Firstly, one needs to define what that is exactly. And secondly, it's a difficult mitzvah to be mekayim, and one has to understand how to be mekayim. The main difficulty is, it's expressed by the Ibn Ezra, in fact, on the Sedra, where the Ibn Ezra says, "V'rabim omru," and many people have said, "Ki ein ovoin b'machsheves halev," that there is no sin in a thought. That merely for thinking something, you shouldn't think. That's not a sin. "V'ein aleim schar v'oinish," and there is not reward and punishment for a thought. That, says the Ibn Ezra, is what many people claim. That in Torah the important thing is the action, as we all know. The mitzvahs are active mitzvahs. You've got to do something. And until you've actually done something, you're not credited with a mitzvah. And until you've actually done something wrong, you're not credited with an avera. Thought alone does not obligate. V'yesh rayis rabois la'ashiv aleihin, says the Ibn Ezra, there are many proofs against them. V'loi arich, and I'm not going to go into the whole thing. And then he goes on to say, the ikar kol hamitzvos, the principle of all the mitzvos, is liyasher halev, is to straighten out the heart. Amazing thing of the Ibn Ezra. The function and the purpose of all the mitzvos is to straighten out the heart. It's not that the heart is just something there that is there to facilitate the doing of the mitzvos. The mitzvos are there to straighten out the ikar kol hamitzvos. And the main principle of all the mitzvahs, that means without exception, the mitzvahs which might appear to be the most ritualistic and the most meaningless in a moral sense, the ikar kol mitzvahs, the function of all the mitzvahs, the purpose of all the mitzvahs, is liyasher halev, is to straighten out the heart. The rubam zecher, and most of the actions that one has to go through are merely reminders to feel in a certain way. They're there to trigger off an emotion, to trigger off a feeling. And the proof that is so, you can see from the different punishments given to a man who does something b'mezid, who does something willfully, and a man who does something b'shoigeg, a man who does something by mistake. So you can have two people that, let's say, murder. One murders willfully, one murders by mistake. One is hanged, or in any way is given the death sentence, and the other one is not. Somebody is mechalel Shabbos. One person is mechalel Shabbos b'mezid, he does it deliberately, and another person is mechalel Shabbos by mistake. One person gets the death sentence, another person just has to bring a korban. What's the difference? The action was the same, but the heart was different. Says the Ibn Ezra, you can see from that that what the Torah really judges and what's really critical is in fact the heart that goes behind the mitzvahs. That doesn't mean that the mitzvah, that the heart alone is enough. Feeling without the expression is also meaningless. But the expression is meaningless without the heart behind it. Ve'ikar kol ha-mitzvahs. And the principle behind all the mitzvahs is le'yasher ha-lev, is to straighten out the heart. That one needs to know. So the Ibn Ezra touches on the difficulty that a lot of people experience, he less than most, because of Ishita and Shemos, which we're still going to learn. How can the Torah give you an instruction, don't covet? What you're going to do is a poor man who's hungry, he hasn't eaten for ages, and the last time he ate, all he had was a dry crust of bread with a bit of water, and the time before that, that's also what he had. And he walks past the house and he sees tables laden with all the most delicious food. The Torah says, Loi tachmod, you mustn't desire it, not for you. How can you do that? It's not human. It's not possible to control your desires. It's possible to control your actions. Maybe it's possible to control your thoughts. But is it possible to be told that you've got to control your desires, what you must desire and what you mustn't desire? It's like many of the Mefoshim, the Ramban says about the Ahavta L'Reacha Kamocha, that you must love your neighbor as yourself. It doesn't mean literally that you must love your neighbor as yourself. It says the Ramban, you can't be given a mitzvah that you shall love. You shall love. Love isn't something you can just turn on and turn off. Some people you love, some people you don't. Yavtel Reacha Kamocha, says the Ramban, means you must relate to everybody as if you love them. The way you handle them, your actions must be as the same as if you love them. But if there can't be a dictation to your emotion that you must feel love, how can you be told thou shalt love? Similarly, a lot of the Mefoshim and a lot of the Poskim have a great deal of difficulty with these mitzvahs, which are two of the Ten Commandments. Lo tachmei. How can you be told not to desire something? To what extent is that really in your control? So the one principle that the Ibn Ezra has really laid down, and that is, don't think that there is no reward and punishment for thoughts. There is. Okay, and in fact that's the ikar of the whole Torah, is the thought that is behind it. The mitzvahs are there to bring about a certain thought. The mitzvahs are there to straighten out the heart and to straighten out the mind. But really what's important at the end of it is that thought and is that mind, and it's for that that you're punished. It's not the action that you're punished for. The action is the expression of the thought. But you're punished for the thought behind it, and that's why if you're mazid, you're punished more severely than if you're shogeg. That's what the Ibn Ezra says. One of the other differences between Shemos and Devorim is that in Shemos, both the 9th and the 10th commandments, the word lo sachmoid is used. Thou shalt not covet. In Va'eschan and in today's Sedra, in the 10th commandment it uses the word v'loi tis'aveh, a different word. The 9th commandment remains the same, loi tachmoid, but the 10th commandment, Moshe Rabbeinu changes the word from loi tachmoid to loi tis'aveh. Means the same thing. Says Rashi, loi tis'aveh, loi teirog. The Unkelus translates that as loi teirog. Af hu loshun chemda. That also is a Loshon of Chemda. It means the same thing. It's a synonym for Loi Tachmoid. It means the same. Nevertheless, the Rambam paskens them as different halachas. In the first perek of Hilchas Gezeilo Va'aveda, the Rambam paskens, Kol ha-choymeid avdoi oi amosoi oi beisoi v'cheilov shol chaveiroi oi dovo she'efshar loi she'yiknehu mimenu. Anybody who desires a man's servant, or his maidservant, or his house, or his kelim, his furniture, or his motor car, or anything which you can buy from him, and he presses the person to sell it to him. We're not even talking about somebody who steals it or who takes it by force. We're talking about you see another person has something which you like, and you start applying the pressure. You want to buy it, and he's not a seller. And you get his friends to start persuading him to sell, and he's not a seller. And you start increasing the price, and he's not a seller. And you, more and more force, afal pishe nosen lo idomim rabim, even though you've paid handsomely for it, hareze over b'loitase shenema loitachmet. You've been over a loitase of loitachmet. It always amazes me. I mention this every time we do this type of thing, but it still amazes me how in our kind of circles, the extent to which we are meticulous about certain halachas and to the extent to which we are ignorant about others. This is one of the Ten Commandments. How many people know these halachas? One of the Ten Commandments, one of the Aseres Hadibros. How many people know these halachas? To what extent may you apply pressure on a seller? To what extent is it permissible? I met a businessman the other day and I said, you know, I don't mind doing business together with you, but I would hate to ever have to buy anything from you or sell anything to you. So he said, I don't understand. He says, that you would hate to buy anything from me. He says, you're right, you've got good reason not to want to do this, such a thing. I understand that. He says, but that you should hate to sell to me. Nobody's ever lost money selling to me. You don't have to sell if you don't want to sell. It's not true. It is true you don't have to sell if you don't want to sell, but everybody has a price. And sometimes one can put an offer before somebody which he can't resist. But that doesn't mean that he really wanted to sell. You forced him to sell. And that's lo tachmoit. You're not allowed to do that. And what is the issue? Not that you forced him to sell, but that you wanted something so badly that you had to force him to sell. That you wanted something that wasn't yours so badly that you had to overpay for it and force and force and force until he sold. That's the issue. But it's an issue d'oraisa. It's a prohibition of the Torah. It's one of the Ten Commandments. If a thing is up for sale, you may buy it. But to force somebody to sell, even with the most attractive offers, something that he doesn't want to sell, that's an issue in the Torah. You're not allowed to do that. However, says the Rambam, you are only over this Aveiro, you only actually transgress this Aveiro when you buy that which you crave, that which you desire. Until the actual purchase takes place, you're not over. That's what the Rambam says. That makes it really easy. So it's like those that the Ibn Ezra talks about and says that they're not correct. The Rambam at this stage holds that the Isser of Loi Tachmoid is an Isser with an action. It's not just the thought. You're punished for the thought, that's true, but you're not punished until you actually bought. You haven't transgressed until you actually bought. To want something so much that you actually go and buy it when it's not for sale, at that point you get punished for retrospectively wanting it that much. But then in Halacha Yud, he carries on. Kol hamis'ave. Now he uses the same word which is used in today's Sedra. Not ha'choymed, but hamis'ave. So you see that he holds that Mis'ave is slightly different, not like Rashi. Anybody who desires the house or the wife or the kelim of his friend, and says such other similar things which is possible for him to acquire from his friend. The moment he thinks in his heart, how can I get this thing? And he's persuaded in his heart to set about trying to achieve it. He's also over a life. And taiva is only the heart. Says the Rambam, chemdo, you're only over when you go and you purchase. That's what we're talking about in Shemos. But in the Ten Commandments, as they are recorded in Devarim, where the word misave is used, says the Rambam, misave means in the heart. And therefore you're over the 10th commandment in Devarim, even when you desire it, as soon as you start scheming how to buy it. That means you can be on the market looking for a house, and you pass a beautiful house that isn't for sale. And you say, now that's a beautiful house. I wonder, could I go and make them an offer? Should I call an estate agent? At that point you've been over an Issur D'oraisa, according to the Rambam. The Issur, the 10th of the 10 commandments, the Issur of Lo Tisave. And if you do go in there, and you do make him an offer, and he sells to you, although he had no intention of selling to anybody, you're over in addition to the Melo Tisave, you are also over Lo Tachmei. We're not allowed to do that. You can ask somebody to go in and say, is he prepared to sell? If he says yes, he's prepared to talk, then you're safe, then everything's alright. But if he says no, and you tell the estate agent, go back and tell him it's a good deal and he'll get a cash offer and the prices are going to be going down soon, it's an opportunity, at that point you're over. You're over Lo Tisave the moment you start scheming, and you're over Lo Tachmei the moment you purchase. Two serious others. I leave it to your own imagination to consider the implications of these halachas and things such as business takeovers. When business off making offers to take over the others, share transactions. The extent to which this all infringes, on the Yisurim of Loitis Ave and Loitachmoid. That's the Rambam, and according to the Rambam it's a little bit easier to understand, because now Loitachmoid is an action. You're not Ove Loitachmoid until you purchase. And Loitis Ave, although it's not an action, and the Rambam says Ein Taivo Elo Belev Bilvad, Taivo means something in the heart. Nevertheless, what is it in the heart? It's when you start scheming how you're going to buy. At that point you're over. But just to walk past the shop window and desire it, or just to walk into somebody's house and think, my goodness, that's beautiful, I wish I had it. That's not an issue according to the Rambam yet. The Rambam obviously holding that there's no way that the Torah expects every individual to be able to control that kind of reaction. Our example with which we started, the poor man is hungry and hasn't eaten anything but dry bread and water for weeks and weeks, walks past this beautiful banquet, he's entitled to feel, if only I had it, if I were a rich man. Good, okay. You can think, if I were a rich man. And you can even think what you would do when you would be a rich man. You can have a seat on the Eastern Wall, you can do what you want, it's lovely, beautiful. But when you start thinking, what do I need to do to become a rich man? Then you're on Loitis Ave, and when you set about doing it, you're on Loitachme. The Chinuch goes a little bit further. Loitachmoid, the Chinuch learns like the Rambam. But Loitis Ave, he learns just a little bit differently. Also, he learns it as a separate mitzvah, separate issue. But you'll see from his wording, it's a little bit more to it. Sheninna'u, we have been, this is in mitzvah Taf Tes Zoyin. Sheninna'u milikvoya machshavtenu lihisavis ma'ashe biyad echod me'achenu b'nei Yisrael. We are prevented from fixing in our minds, likvoya machshavtenu, fixing our minds to desire something which belongs to another Jew. That's how the Chinuch defines it. So again, it's more active. It's not just you walk past and you know, you had this tremendous desire. Okay, that can happen. That's not an issue according to the Chinuch. It's less physical than the Rambam in a sense, because the Rambam says you actually plan as to how to get it. That's when you're over. Let's just look at the steps. So the poor man walks past the food and he thinks, if only I could have that, no issue. If he thinks to himself, what can I do to get it? Is there a chance I could steal it? Do you think I could go and buy it? Could I offer to work for it? What can I do to get some of that food? That's Loitis Ave according to the Rambam. If he goes and he offers to buy it or whatever, that's Loitachmoid according to the Rambam. According to the Chinuch, even if he just makes an effort at wanting it, if you know what I mean, he consciously wants it. He says to them, now that I would like, and he consciously introduces into his mind the feasibility of having those good things. That's already Loitis Ave. So it's one degree more delicate than the Rambam. You don't actually have to plot how to get it. It's bad enough just wanting it. However, it's not just a thought, a casual thought of wanting it. It's likvoya makshavtenu lis avos, to turn our minds to wanting something. That's what's no good. It's very close to the Rambam, but it's one degree lighter. But it's still not like Rashi. Because Rashi says that Loitachmoid and Loitis Ave is the same. And since Rashi, and since Moshe Rabbeinu and Dvorim uses the word Loitis Ave, one thing is clear, that Loitis Ave doesn't involve any action. Loitis Ave means just to want. As the Rambam says, Ein Taivo Elo Belev, that everybody agrees. So if Rashi holds the taiva that Loitis Ave and Loitachmoid is the same Isur, unlike the Rambam and unlike the Chinuch, Rashi must mean that in both of them you don't need an action. And you're over as soon as you have a thought. What thought? So what Rashi himself holds is not clear, but there's an Ibn Ezra in Shmois that I want to learn with you, and this Ibn Ezra is the most amazing thing. In fact, that's the whole shiur. I'm just going to read and translate to you the Ibn Ezra. It's not long. But if the world would know this Ibn Ezra, a lot of things would change. The Ibn Ezra deals with one thing directly and with another thing indirectly. Directly, he deals with the question of to what extent a person can control his thoughts, his desires, his cravings, his ambitions. To what extent a person is meant to, is held responsible for his thoughts and for his feelings. And more important, assuming, as we're going to assume, that a person can be held responsible for his thoughts and for his feelings, how do you control them? How do you do it? It's no good giving us a Torah that says Loitachmoid and Loitis Ave without giving us the technique of how to achieve it. What he deals with indirectly is the whole relationship between the moral laws and the ritual laws. Is it possible to be a moral human being without believing in the Ribbono Shel Olam? Without believing that the Ribbono Shel Olam, let's put it this way, when I talk about believing in the Ribbono Shel Olam, I'm talking about believing in a God who watches every individual, cares for him, gives him what he needs, rewards him and punishes him. Is it possible to be a moral human being without that belief? So obviously you're fully aware there's a huge section of the Western population, of Western civilization, that holds that you can. They call themselves moralists. You don't have to be religious to be a good human being. That one has to define what is meant by a good human being. Before we do the Ibn Ezra, I must tell you that the Avi Ezra says in Dvorim that he believes that this 10th commandment is the fundamental commandment of all the other 10. That this is the most important of all of them. And that the whole Torah rests on this last commandment. So we're dealing with a real cornerstone. Says the Ibn Ezra, Anoshim Rabim Yismuhu Al Zois HaMitzvah. Many people are amazed at this mitzvah. How is it possible that there can be a man who will not desire even the most beautiful thing just in his heart? Will see something terribly beautiful and won't desire it. Whatever he himself happens to find attractive, what does attractive mean after all? Attractive means you like it. So does that mean there's an issue in finding something attractive? Ask Ibn Ezra, how is it possible to have a situation where you have a person who is never covets, never wants, never desires something which he finds beautiful and attractive? The ato etin l'chol moshe, and I will give you an example. Says the Ibn Ezra, he's going to answer that question. In other words, we see already that the Ibn Ezra's view is unlike the Rambam and it's unlike the Chinuch, but that lo itachmoid means literally. Just wanting it is already the Avera, because according to the Rambam and the Chinuch, that has already been answered. What's the Ibn Ezra's kasha? How can you have a person who doesn't want something he finds attractive? So we've answered that already. The issue is not to want it. You're allowed to want it. According to the Rambam, as long as you don't actually plot and scheme how to get it, and even according to the Chinuch, as long as you don't fix your mind on it and really become fixated on it. If it's just a casual thing, you saw something beautiful and you like it, good, okay, that's not the issue. The fact that the Ibn Ezra asks the question indicates that according to the Ibn Ezra, the 9th and 10th commandment entails merely wanting something. Just seeing something beautiful and thinking, it would be nice to have that. That, according to the Ibn Ezra, is awesome. That's the 9th and 10th commandment. And therefore, the Ibn Ezra has a strong question. How is it possible not to want something that you see, which is very beautiful? Just a little bit, just to think to yourself, wouldn't it be nice if I had it? Da, no. A man from the village, a person out from the land, a farmhand. Okay, now in their day, a farmhand was like in our day, in South Africa. Right, so go out to the Free State, onto one of the farms, miles from anywhere, and take a farmhand, a black farmhand from there. That's the kind of person he's talking to. A person, sheyeshle das nechayna, but he's normal, not abnormal. Vehu ro'o bas melech shehi yofa. And he saw a very beautiful princess, the daughter of a king. He hears that Lady Diana's had a baby. Interesting. Lo yachmoidoy sabelibo sheyish gavim. He doesn't crave to take her with him to bed. It doesn't enter his mind. Remember, we were talking about the farmhand, beautiful princess. He has no desire to marry this girl. Ki yodo kizeh lo yitochen, because he knows it's absolutely impossible. This is an unbelievable yesod. Something that you know is absolutely impossible, you don't desire. You only desire things which are feasibly, at least in your imagination, possible. V'al tachshuv zeh kafri shu keechod min ha-meshugoyim she'yisave she'yilu k'nafayim le'oif ha-shamayim v'lo yitochin li'yis. Don't think that this simple farmhand is like a meshugina who desires, looks at a bird and craves, oh, if only I had wings like that. That's a meshugina. And if only you have wings. You don't have wings, you'll never have wings, it's not possible. Stop desiring, stop craving. If you see a person looking at a bird and with a taiva, he can't take his mind off this bird. Why? Because the bird can fly and I want wings too. You'll say, you're a meshugina, you need to see somebody. So says the Ibn Ezra, if you'll take this farmhand there from the farm that's 250 miles from Bloemfontein in the direction of Barkley East or somewhere, not in the direction of Kimberley or Johannesburg, and you take that farmhand off from the farm in the Free State, and you'll see he's madly in love. You'll say, who's the colour? Who are you so in love with? Ah, Lady Di. You have to see somebody. It's not normal for a person to be in love with somebody that he cannot possibly marry. Kasher ein odom misave lishkoiv im imoy afal pishehi yofe. It's the same principle, says the Ibn Ezra. This Ibn Ezra is just amazing. That is responsible for a man not to have any sexual desire to establish a relationship with his mother, no matter how beautiful she is. It's the same yesod. Ki hirgilu mina urov lodash hi asuroloi. Because they taught him from childhood that that's a relationship which cannot exist. It's completely taboo. In the family, outside the family, in society, in religion, everywhere. It's just not on. And therefore there's never even a desire, no matter how beautiful she is. Let's just stop there for a moment and see what's happened here. This is a psychological and a legal revelation. The Ibn Ezra. The principle is laid down is that you only have a taiva for something you believe is possible. And therefore, if you have a taiva to fly like a bird, you're mad, because that means you believe you could fly. That's why you're mad. And if the farmhand out in Bloemfontein has a taiva for Lady Di, he's mad too, because it means that he believes it's feasible, it's possible. He's maladjusted, there's something wrong. A normal person will not crave anything which is totally impossible. You need also to understand and appreciate what a taiva is. There isn't an English word for a taiva. Because I think the English culture doesn't want to acknowledge that there exists any emotion so powerful as a taiva. And I think with our English upbringing, we stifle our taivas to such an extent that we aren't aware ourselves quite how powerful a taiva can be. A taiva is a craving, a desire, but there just isn't an English word. It's much more powerful than all those things put together. Of course, there are degrees. You can have small taivas and big taivas, but that's what a taiva is. A taiva is the beginning of everything else. Rabbeinu Yonah says in Pirkei Avos that Hakol nimshach achar ha-taiva. Everything comes after taiva. First you want something, then you take steps to do it. All the wrong that we do results from taiva, and all the right that we do results from taiva. The Rambam himself says it. Ha-taiva mevi'o lidei chimut. Taiva, desire of something, brings you to be chomed, to desire it to the point where you'll actually try and force somebody to sell it to you. Va'chimut mevi lidei gezel. And if you desire it to that extent, if he refuses to sell it to you, you'll steal. Steal doesn't mean necessarily that you'll break into his house and take it, but you'll find dishonest means of achieving it. Shim lo yirotza abaylim limkor, if he doesn't want to sell up a pishu boloim bedamim, even though you've offered him a lot of money, to bereim, and you've got friends to persuade him, yovali de gezel. Vim omdu abaylim befonov lahatzir mamoinon. And then one becomes mad. Let's say that you're actually going to break into the house. You've set your mind on it, you've fixated on it, you've got to have it no matter what, and it's the only one in the world. You've offered him millions and he won't sell it to you. So you've decided you're going to break in and steal it. Terrible thing, you claim from insurance. He doesn't appeal for it, he doesn't appreciate it in any case. It's the insurance company, they make enough money. Anyway, you ration to yourself, it will disappear, he'll claim from insurance, he'll get the money for it, I'll get the object, everybody will be happy. What happens if you break in and he stands up against you? He hears you break in and you didn't know he was in the house and you come, what are you going to do then? You'll murder him, you'll kill him. And that brings you to Shvichas Damim. Taiva is the beginning of everything. If people didn't have taiva, there's a lot of things they wouldn't do. There are many good things they wouldn't do, and there are many bad things they wouldn't do. Taiva is the beginning of everything. The Ibn Ezra has said at this point that the reason that a normal human being, that a normal man, does not have any sexual desire towards his mother is because he's been educated from early youth that that's a relationship which is totally taboo and wouldn't be allowed at all. It's not a possible relationship. I'm sure you've been reading in the papers, both here and overseas papers, of the rising incidence of incest. Very disturbing. And people like to make out that it's always been, but it's only becoming known now. That's always the excuse. It's always been, divorce has always been, it's just become public now. Incest, always been, it's just become public now. It's all a lot of nonsense. It couldn't always be. It wasn't. The divorce rate wasn't what it is today. And the unhappy marriage rate wasn't what it is today. That's all a lot of nonsense. Ah, in those days they were also unhappy, but divorce was taboo, so they didn't get divorced. No, divorce was taboo, so they stayed happy. That's what it is. And incest was taboo, so they didn't have incest. Why is incest becoming so popular all of a sudden? Because the more and more one reads about it, the more one sees about it, it's no longer in the realm of the impossible. It's not so completely taboo. It's naughty and it's bad and it's wrong, but it's not impossible. And the moment that happens, the whole moral structure that a human being bases his beliefs on and his behavior on is shattered. That's what we call pritzas geder when we talk about breaking the fence. That's what we're talking about. Pritzas geder, the first people who break an accepted practice, it's a terribly serious thing. Because once you've broken the fence, anything is allowed. I mentioned in a shiur a couple of weeks ago about the legal rethinking that is going in as a result of the Hinckley case. That there seems to be something wrong with people being able to murder. And 9 times out of 10 they're getting off. I think that's an exaggeration. I don't think it's 9 times out of 10, but it's an ever increasing proportion of people are getting off on the grounds of insanity. And the legal men are beginning to say that ultimately everybody is insane. What is the definition of insanity as given by the Ibn Ezra? Anybody who has a craving for something which is impossible is insane. But if it's not impossible, it isn't insane. So you say, a man who murders, there's something wrong with a man who murders. No. There's something wrong with a man who murders in a society where he might be able to get away with it. If everybody would know that come what may, you murder, you hang. That's all. No insanity, no extenuating circumstances, nothing. You murder, you hang. There's nothing to talk about. If everybody knew that, murders would stop very quickly. The occasional thing you'd hear of a murder. Because people would know the consequences. Murder is suicide. And people would stop murdering. It would only be a real madman who would murder then, and the madman would have to be killed too. Because if you don't kill the madman, then we start the whole thing again. People start seeing, if you're mad and you murder, it's not suicide. So let's get mad. So you wouldn't be able to do that. It would have to be just a blanket law. Anybody who murders is killed. That's it. The moment it starts becoming feasible to be able to commit a murder and survive it, no longer is murder in the realms of the impossible. And people's moral structure starts changing. Let's go on a little bit in the Ibn Ezra. Kacha kol maskil tzorich sheyedo. So every intelligent person needs to know. Ki isho yofo oimomoin. Lo yimtzeenu odom bavur chochmosoi vedatoi. Raka asher cholak loy Hashem. Every intelligent person needs to know that a pretty lady or money will not come to a man because of his intelligence and his knowledge or his power, but will come to him because the Ribbono Shel Olam wants him to have it. That's what you need to know. And it needs to be very clear in your mind. V'omar Koheles, as Koheles said, l'adam sh'loy omar bo yitnenu chelko, that you can have a wise man who really one thing deserves wealth, and at the end of his life he ends up paying it all out to strangers for one reason or another. And the Gemara also says in Brochus that children, life and panosa, the living, one's financial situation, is not totally on one's own merits. You can have a tzaddik and he's poor. You can have a rosho and he's rich. You can have a tzaddik and he's got a big family. And you can have a rosho who's got a big family and he's well off and everything's wonderful. Good health, children, wealth, the lot. And you can have a tzaddik who has none of it. He has no children, he has no wealth, and he has no health. So the Gemara, those three things are not in any way a factor of a man's intelligence or stature. But it's the mazal talia milta. That's the Ribbono Shel Olam's gezeiros. There are other things that dictate this type of thing, those three areas. uva'avur zeh, and because of this, ha'maskil lo yis'aveh v'lo yachmoit. An intelligent person will not desire anything and he will not sit after anything. As long as he knows it's impossible, if it's to be, it will be without your desiring it. And if it's not to be, nothing you can do will possibly get it to you. The moment a thing becomes morally impossible, immediately the desire is able to be turned off. It's an unbelievable Muslim. That one is capable of controlling not only one's actions, that we know. That one is capable of controlling not only one's thoughts, that we know too. That we're capable of controlling them and we have to control them. But that you're even capable of controlling your desires. But you need to create a barrier, a moral barrier, which is as strong as a physical barrier. Just as you know that you can't get to the moon, so you need to know that you can't take that man as your wife, that lady as your wife, because she's married to somebody else. It's got to be equally impossible to you. Going to the moon and marrying her has to be equally impossible. If it's not equally impossible, then you cannot control your taiva, you cannot control your desire. And according to the Rambam, once you can't control your desire, you can't control your chemda. If you can't control your chemda, you can't control setting your about going, doing whatever you can to achieve the ends which you shouldn't be achieving. And so one leads it to another, and things are completely out of control. To know that somebody else's property, somebody else's money, somebody else's business is not yours, you hands off. You may not touch. It cannot ever come to you. It's not yours, and it never will be yours. It's impossible for it to be yours. If one has that clearly in one's mind, you'll take your mind off it. And if it isn't clearly in your mind, you'll want it and want it and want it. And the more you want it, the more you continue to want it. And the more that happens, then again, you start scheming. What can I do? How can I get it? And you're over litzaven, you're over litachmoid, and you do all sorts of things in your efforts to get something which you have no business getting in the first place.
Ve'omar sheyedo she'esh Yisra'ehu osro Hashem loy yoser hi nizgovo be'eno v'baz melech b'lev ha'kafri.
You have to know that a woman who is prohibited to a man is more unattainable in your eyes than the princess is in the eyes of the farmhand. Put it as impossible. The Ibn Ezra uses the word nisgovo for unobtainable. Or unattainable. Nisgava means elevated. She is the woman which the Torah has forbidden to you is more elevated. That's literally what it means. More elevated, not more unattainable, but the literal translation is she's more elevated than the princess is to the farmhand. And that throws a lot of light on the whole understanding of the halachas that govern the relationship between the sexes. That the purpose is not just to create a barrier because terrible and you can't touch and you can't see it. It's to raise to a level exactly like the farmhand and the princess. It's the covered of the woman which is protected by these halachas. That the woman is unattainable because of her elevated state. The fact that she's married to somebody or whatever it is, it's because of her elevated state that she's unattainable. And this gova, she's more elevated even than the princess is to the farmhand. Let's just stop there, and there are only two or three more lines of the Ibn Ezra which we need to understand. But before that, let's just understand what the problem now is. So now, your friend has bought himself a new television set or motor car or yacht or whatever you want. And you have a problem, you have a taiva for it. You would like it too. And you're trying to control that taiva. Because you know it's an issur, according to the Ibn Ezra, merely to want it is already an issur. And you don't want to go around with that in your head. Apart from anything else, it disturbs you to go around all the time wanting what somebody else has got. This syndrome of the grass is greener on the other side is all what we're talking about. Always you're wanting something that you don't have. You want a situation that you don't have. You want an experience that somebody else is having. You want an environment that somebody else has got. You want an opportunity that somebody else has got. It's always the same story. And it's bothering you. It stops you enjoying what you have got. You have no time to enjoy what you are and what you've got because you're busy wanting something that you don't have. So you've decided, now, I must remember that Ibn Ezra in Shmos chapter Kaf, and I want to get this out of my mind. So you start saying, well, that yacht that he's got, it's not possible. I can't get it.
Let's say that finance is not a restriction. The reason you want the yacht is not just because it costs a lot of money, but because it's really a very unique yacht. Something that money can't buy. And you've got limitless financial resources. So you want it. So what do you do? How do you stop? So you say, I must remind myself, it cannot be, I cannot have it. Why can't you have it? And if you'll sell it, everybody's got a price. So what mechanism do you now need to employ to make sure that you understand firmly that you cannot have it? Says the Ibn Ezra. V'lo yotzi mel liboy lachmo delisa, avo istova sheina shelay, and you won't allow your heart to desire something which is not yours. Ki yedo shashem lo yrotzo lo seslo, you knew that God didn't want to give it to you. And what God doesn't want to give you, lo yuchel lekachtoi bekoicho, you cannot take by strength, of a machshavoisov v'tachbuloisov, or by thought or by scheming. Al kein yivtach bevoiro sheyechalkilenu, you should trust that God will look after you. V'yase atoiv be'enov, and you should do what's good in God's eyes. And that's it. Says the Ibn Ezra at the end, the whole thing now depends on your belief in Hashgacha. On your belief that God gives you what you need, and that's all. He will not give you anything that you don't need, and that once God has decided what you need and what you don't need, nothing will enable you to achieve more than that. That needs to be believed. And that's the unterste, that's the bottom line. Unless you're able to believe that God decides what you're going to have and what you're not going to have in terms of material possession, unless you believe that, there's no way you're going to be able to satisfy yourself in saying, I cannot have that, that's not possible for me to have. It's necessary to have that barrier. You've got to, the same as getting from here to the moon, there's got to be that barrier established between you and the yacht. And there's only one thing that can establish that barrier, and that's God's hand. Ad kan, no, you can't come here. When Adam was thrown out of the Garden of Eden and God put those angels there, Adam lost all his desire to ever go back, because he knew it was not possible to go back under those circumstances. Then God stands in between and says, Ad kan, you cannot come any further. And if we would see the hand of the Ribbono Shel'olam standing in front of that yacht and saying, Ad kan, you cannot come any further, then put your hands on this and then put your eyes on it. It's not yours and it never will be yours. If God said that to you, the example that I gave in the ladies' shiur this morning, just imagine that God came and said word for word, the whole place started trembling and there was lightning and thunder and light started flashing and the shofar sound started getting louder and louder, and all of a sudden you heard this voice coming from everywhere, I am the Lord your God, thou shalt not have that yacht. Good, so what are you going to go and argue? That's the end of your desire. And all you need to know is with that same degree of clarity that thou shalt not have that yacht. But for that you've got to believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam. What happens if you don't have that trust fully? You believe that the Ribbono Shel Olam decides what you get, but if you work a little bit harder, maybe you can get a little bit more. That's what you believe. The Ribbono Shel Olam decided you should earn 1,000 rand a month. But that's on the way you were last year. You were a lazy so-and-so last year. The Ribbono Shel Olam didn't realize how hard you can really work. So I'm going to work a lot harder this year, and I'm going to earn 2,000 rand a month. Off you go to earn your 2,000 rand a month. If that's the way you believe, then your tithe cannot be controlled. The moment you see an opportunity to make an extra 50 rand, starts working. Your heart starts working, your mind starts working, click, 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 lotisave, letachmoy, one after the other, one starts being over them. And you start thinking about it, one thing after another, and it's all gone. The bottom, the foundation is the trust and the knowledge that you cannot overstep what the Ribbono Shel Olam has set aside for you. He's decided, and his barriers cannot be transgressed. What is for so-and-so is not for you, and what is for you is not for so-and-so. And so-and-so can't take away from me, and I can't take away from so-and-so. It's not possible. It cannot be. It's as clear as the physical laws of nature. The same as apples don't fall up, they fall down. So, with the same degree of clarity and absolute truth, it is not possible for anybody to take what is mine, and it is not possible for me to take what is anybody else's. And I need to know that as clearly as I know that apples don't fall up. When I know that, then I can start operating. Now I can start turning off my tithes. In all areas, I can stop desiring situations that are not for me. I can stop having ambitions that are not for me. I can stop wanting things that are not mine. I can stop wanting to have relationships with people with whom I'm not allowed to have such relationships. Everything can be handled, because I know that there's this iron barrier between me and the things that I desire.
So now the moralist comes to you and he says you can be a good human being without being religious. The answer to that is, how good a human being can you be? Can you stop yourself from wanting something which isn't yours? Can you stop yourself from wanting a relationship with a woman with whom you cannot have that relationship? Can you stop yourself having an ambition which is an ambition that you shouldn't have? I bread and water, and the time before was the same. Would you be able to stop yourself wanting food which you saw laid out on the table? If the answer is no, then the question is, so how good a human being can you be? Can you really trust yourself to be such a good human being? Because ultimately, if you are that poor man and you want that food, it's going to lead you to dishonest means unless you can turn it off at the point of desire. Once you've got the tithe, it's too late. Once you've got the desire, there's not that much you can do to remain straight and honest. You've got to be able to turn the desire off at the critical point. And how can you do that if you don't trust that there's a God who has decided what is yours and what isn't yours? As long as you believe it is possible to get what is somebody else's, you will desire it and you will crave for it. It needs to be believed that it is impossible. And then you would have to be a meshugana to strive for it and to crave for it. I said to you that the Avi Ezer says that this is the basis of all the Ten Commandments and therefore of the whole of Yiddishkeit. Because he says at the end of it, Roiv Averis Boim Michimud Mama in Oichimud Znus. Most of the Averis are committed because people want money that isn't theirs, meaning any material things that aren't theirs, or there's sex behind it. I mean, if you look at any of the successful novels or movies or whatever it is, that the theme has got to be money or sex. That's what leads people to do all the things that they shouldn't do. And people read these novels and go to these movies because at least if they're things which they shouldn't do and don't do, it's nice to see somebody else doing them. And it's all motivated at the end of it by chimud momun or oznus. V'terem oiver avera choymed b'liboy tachlis momun amagia mimeno. Before you do an avera, you already work out in your mind the desirability of the profitability of doing the avera. You're in the witness box and you've got to say something. You start weighing up. If you're going to tell the absolute honest truth, how much is it going to cost you? And okay, so there's an avera and telling a lie, but you start weighing up. And what brings you to say something which is not absolutely true? The fear of losing money. So because of the fear of losing money, you're prepared to be over one of the Ten Commandments. You'll say something which is not altogether right. Yushvu Asheker. You're asked to make an oath. The judge doesn't believe you altogether, so he says, will you swear? Now you're in trouble. To say, no, I won't swear. I've just given evidence. So I have to swear. Well, so your conscience starts ticking. To make an oath which is false. But if I don't, I'm out. The creditors are at the... My house goes. I've got nowhere for my family. Everything I've got goes. I'm on the street. I'm sure the Ribbono Shel Olam will understand this time too. Why are you so sure that the Ribbono Shel Olam will understand? Because you want the money, you want the house, that's why. Your tithe is there, you're so attached to your material possessions that if it needs a Shvuah Sheker, then it'll be a Shvuah Sheker, that's just how it'll be. V'asis melocha b'Shabbos. Comes a time. Shabbos, we're not talking about working on Shabbos. But Friday afternoon, and it's 5 minutes before Shkia, and I think I can finish the deal before Shabbos. At worst, it'll be a minute after Shabbos comes in. All I'll have to do is sign. Nothing else. If I don't sign, I lose everything. If I sign, I make a million. If I don't sign, I lose everything. So we'll try and hurry it up that it should be before Shabbos. And comes, and you're waiting, and you're waiting, and you look at your watch, and you know your watch is accurate, and Shkia is in 10 seconds, and the man is looking for his pencil, for his pen, he wants you to sign, he's fumbling in his pocket, and you're going out of your mind, oh, then he finds the pencil. I'm sure my watch is 10 seconds slow. 10 seconds fast. I'm sure. Quickly you sign. Chil Shabbos. Why? The dollar signs. It just means too much to you. To sacrifice the money for Shabbos, you can't do it. So you justify. Veretzeach. Murder. Ultimately the same. V'chein machmas chemdas moment togeh b'chvei geldov. And very often because of this desire for progress in the world, one does things against one's parents which one shouldn't do. To be seen by one's colleagues showing honor to one's old-fashioned parents, not good for business. And sometimes even idolatry you commit, because that's the done thing among your business associates and colleagues.
You'll do things which are borderline, which are not right, which come close to idolatry. Why? Just to get a bit further. And everything is subjected to getting a bit further and to getting a little bit further. Since the Aviezer, the whole Torah, at the end of it, is hangs on this hair's thread of the Isur of Eloi Tachmai. If only we knew how to control our desires, we would have a key to success for the whole Torah. You could stop yourself doing any Avera and you could bring yourself to do any mitzvah, as long as you could operate at the root, at the desire point you have to operate. Once the desire is there, it's terribly hard. It can be done, but it's terribly hard. If we could only turn it off at the desire point, look what could be saved. Look what could be stopped. Look what could be achieved if one could only control one's desires. Ibn Ezra has given us here the way of doing it. You don't desire something which is impossible. And it's necessary to create a framework of moral impossibilities. Certain things which just cannot be done. Not just because you believe they're wrong, not just because the Torah says they're wrong, but because you see God standing there and saying, oh no, this not. And when that's there, then you're on safe ground. Then you can handle yourself. As I mentioned earlier, we would then be surprised at how few pleas of insanity there would be. People just wouldn't be so insane so quickly. One of the other areas where this becomes very critical is in the area of homosexuality. The medical and psychological world is an absolute state of absolute confusion with how to handle homosexuality. Another one of these things which has just become very popular all of a sudden, and the story being that it always has been, but it's been in the secret. A lot of nonsense. It hasn't been in the secret, it hasn't been in the open. Yeah, there's always been a bit of it, but not in the epidemic sort of quantities that one has it today. And the approach is very much the same as the approach of a murder. Nebuch, they're people who are not normal. So must they be discriminated against? And that approach is in itself what causes the spread of the homosexuality. The moment that it's understood by society that it's something which can be condoned on the basis of insanity, everybody goes insane all of a sudden. It becomes popular to be a little bit insane. Of course everybody's insane. Anybody who wants something which is impossible is insane, but it doesn't become impossible anymore. It becomes possible. It becomes something which can be condoned. And therefore it becomes more feasible. And there are many ways of treating homosexuality. It's a combination of a lot of factors, and one mustn't oversimplify it. But the very first thing you need is to be able to treat homosexuality in an environment which is favorable to treating it. You can't treat homosexuality in San Francisco. You can't do it. Somebody comes to you in San Francisco and says, I have a homosexual problem. The first thing you have to do is get him out of San Francisco. Because in San Francisco, homosexuality is normal. There's nothing wrong with it. So what's the problem? So, well, I think it's a problem. Still, then you've got to get out of San Francisco. The first thing you've got to do is you've got to create an environment for people where it not only is it not normal, but it's not possible. And a person has to know that it's wrong, that it's seriously wrong, that it's taboo, and that these things are not done. We don't do it. Finished. Then the psychologists say, but that puts him in a state of severe guilt feelings and complexes. Yes, it does. But it's those guilt complexes which will help him finally solve his problem. How are you going to help a man solve a problem if he doesn't have a guilt complex about the problem? The very first step in sugar is to say, I did wrong. And until a man feels that what he's doing is wrong, there's no way you can start helping him. The very first thing is for him to have that guilt complex. And that guilt complex has to be created by the knowledge that this is not allowed. It's the complete opposite therapy that is used anywhere else today. And all the other therapies are totally a waste of time and don't achieve any results whatever. Except occasionally when it's a clinical thing and it's treated in a clinical way. But when it's a psychological thing, as it is in 90% of the cases, the treatment is unsuccessful. And it's unsuccessful because it operates in the atmosphere of the psychologist starts with his counseling, look, don't feel so guilty about it. I've been terribly wrong about it. It's not that serious. You would like to lead a healthy heterosexual life, so we need to treat it, but don't get so worried about it. How can you treat a person in that environment? How can you treat a murderer or a potential murderer in an environment that says, look, if you're insane, it's okay, you're allowed to murder. It's not that serious if you're mad. The whole situation develops where madness becomes a heter for transgression. Insanity becomes an excuse for transgression. What the Ibn Ezra tells us is the opposite.
transgression is a cure for insanity. When people understand what it means to transgress, and that this is a transgression and we don't allow it in our society, and we punish it in our society, that cures insanity.
It's a complete reversal of the way we look at things. And how a society could be cleaned up of criminals and of misfits and of psychologically unbalanced people if these gedorim, if these fences would be restructured and made very, very clear. It's not the insanity which makes permissible, which makes transgression permissible, but rather, says the Ibn Ezra, it is the transgression which can resolve and solve the insanity. And that's the chiddush of the Isur of Loi Tachmoid, that a human being has it within his power to control his desires. He is responsible for his desires. His desires lead him to the good things he does, and it leads him to the bad things he does. And once he's on the desire level, it's a downhill roll. He can't do very much to stop himself. Momentum gathers. The only time he really can control himself is at the desire level. And the critical thing to control at the desire level is the understanding of the barriers of what may be and what may not be. And in the area of possession, in the area of money, and in the area of the normal desires, whether it's sexual possession or financial possession, the important thing is to understand the trust in Hashgacha. That ultimately the Rabbeinu Shlom has set aside what each person is going to have and what each person needs. And nothing in the world will he ever allow to transgress those barriers. And it's a waste of time even trying. All the effort that goes into trying to cross those barriers is a waste of time because it cannot be achieved. When that's understood, we'll be able to control our tithes. And when we're able to control our tithes, we'll find that the observance of the Torah, the way the Torah needs to be observed in all its meticulousness and care, will become a lot easier and a lot more constructive for us all. Bearing in mind, as the Ibn Ezra said at the beginning of the shiur, that Ikar Kol HaMitzvahs, that the purpose of all the mitzvahs is Liyasher HaLev, to straighten out the heart, so that one should be people who have not average desires, and not average thoughts, and not average emotions, but normal healthy emotions, normal healthy desires, and normal healthy feelings.